Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for listening at home. And first up, we're going to open our first public hearing on House Bill 3451. And I'd like to ask our colleague, Representative Hoyle, if she'd come and join us first. Representative Hoyle. Yes, that's just fine. Whoever, your friend of yours is a friend of ours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So, for the record, I'm Val Hoyle. I represent West Eugene and Junction City, and I'm very pleased to be here today, and thank you for hearing this bill. I have to say, everybody in this whole building, I'm not the most likely person to sponsor this bill, because I don't come to this to fishing. I'm not a fishing person, but I spent 25 years working in the outdoor industry, and I understand the impact on our economy, jobs in the outdoor industry. We moved to Oregon specifically so that we can enjoy the outdoors and we can enjoy Oregon. And the Mackenzie River is an amazing natural resource. For generations, we've had people fishing on this river, and recently, NOAA has put forward a plan to make sure that we can have a Chinook salmon recovery plan. And when that happened, there were a number of people that were very concerned, because when NOAA made recommendations, they wanted to ensure that we had a local voice at the table to make sure local interest had a voice in how the federal plan was implemented. We've talked with ODFNW, we've talked with interested parties, and this sets up a task force at no cost to the state that has local interest represented to have a voice at the table on how this plan should be implemented. I think that it's very important that we have local voices, that we have the people that are using the river, that are making their living off the river, have a voice in how things should happen, as opposed to having something just happen to us. So that's what this bill creates. It creates a task force, and I think it's a good bill. It should pass, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for our colleague? Representative Krieger.
The makeup of your task force, that we have the user groups like Guys and Packers or local guides, those type of people, in other words, someone like myself from Curry County, I can be on there maybe, but I really don't know the issues or the history, the culture of that area.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, actually, we've just put amendments in outlining who should be on this task force. We're recommending it be between 7 and 9 people, and you maybe could be on this task force, but what we're recommending is that local interested parties, and we gave recommendations, local guide groups, fly fishers, someone from the watershed, from local elected officials, but specifically all the local groups that have an interest in the river. There have been a number of people who've talked about these issues, and people have really strong opinions on what should happen with the river. But again, the amendments that will be coming forward will outline that this group should consist specifically of local interested parties.
I don't have a question, but an admonition. Representative, you mentioned that you're not a fisher person, but that you are interested.
Yes.
And I would commend to you the letter, the floor letter today from Peter Buckley regarding Vice Chair Krieger.
I'm going to bring that up.
Because you've got to be careful.
I did read that letter, Mr. Chair, and I can assure you that when I do go fishing, and a number of people since I sponsored this bill have offered to take me fishing, I would not use dynamite.
Fine. Jonathan, you're up. Thank you, Representative.
Co-Chairs Gilliam and Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton. I'm not here representing any group. I don't have any clients in this matter. I'm here solely as an Oregonian. The Mackenzie River was the first river I fished on when I moved to Oregon in the year 2000. I've caught more fish on that river than any other, which maybe is saying something, maybe not, depending on how you interpret that, based on my fishing skills. But since I have been in Oregon, I've heard many different groups who use the Mackenzie River articulate many different opinions about how it should be managed. And it's been a subject of controversy, as Representative Hoyle just said, that people are very passionate about this resource. And with the federal government now paying more attention to it, we started this effort to say, you know, let's get the local folks who care about the river around the table and have some input in what the federal government may or may not impose on our communities. And the thing that I love about this bill is, I think, similar to what Representative Hoyle expressed, that of all the groups who use this river, there's one thing that no matter how contentious and how controversial sometimes, you know, the battle unfortunately gets, I believe that everybody who uses that river loves that river, and everybody wants to see it managed well. And if we get a task force, which is not going to be funded through any state dollars, but just funded privately, with a professional mediator, to sit down and we can have these conversations in a way that we can express a local voice based on our shared values of loving that river, that I think we can move the ball forward and come back with some recommendations to state agency and to the legislature in years ahead, so that we've got input into the question, and let's give it a shot to see if we can come up with a shared vision and a shared approach for implementing what may be coming down the pipe. And so I just really want to thank Representative Hoyle for her leadership on this and saying, you know what, I believe that we can come together as Oregonians who love this river and try to work something out. And there's really no harm in giving it a shot, and I think that it's really worth doing.
Thank you for adding that. And I want to thank you both for coming. And speaking of moving forward, I'm going to bring the next panel up, and thank you both for coming. Matt Delaney, Tom Wolf, and Jeff DeVore, if you'd come forward. As they're coming forward, I want to remind everybody we got a full agenda if you've had a chance to take a look at it. We are eager to have your testimony on this bill or any other bill that you're here for, but I need you to summarize and hit the high points. We'd be glad to take any printed written testimony that you have. We can take it today or you can submit it later. But please don't read from testimony. But hit the highlights. We're eager to hear from you. And one last reminder, it's about cell phones. Go ahead and put them on stun or quiet, if you would. Tom, you're up.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and my organization supports House Bill 3451, and I'm here representing the 2,800 members of our organization in the state and the 470 chapter members we have that live in the Eugene-McKenzie area. I don't know if you know this, but currently in Oregon has more wild and scenic rivers than any other state in the country. It is a state of rivers. We have more river miles than most states. We are a state full of beautiful and scenic rivers that support native salmon and trout and steelhead. One of the most beautiful of that is the McKenzie River, which was the birthplace of the McKenzie drift boat, which has become the prototype for many of the drift boats used across the country for fishing. So it has got a proud history, and it currently houses the only viable run of wild spring Chinook still left in the upper Willamette. So it's important for many, many reasons. And we support this stakeholder group. Hopefully there will be a Trout Unlimited from the local area on that group, but we think that this is the best way to resolve many of the conflicts that have come out lately. So I don't need to really continue any longer than that, but we definitely support this bill and hope that you'll pass it through. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. There's a mistake on Matt Delaney. He'll do another bill. Did Jeff DeVore leave the room, or is he with us? Come right on up. And if Joe Rolliter and Stan Steele are here. Tom, if you'll give up your seat, but hang close in case we've got questions for you at the end of the panel, Tom. And please, go right ahead and introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Chairperson, representatives, my name is Jeff DeVore. I live in Pleasant Hill, Oregon. I have grandchildren that live in West Eugene, so I'm represented here. I'm past chairman, president of the McKenzie Fly Fishers, and I'm currently their conservation chair. And I checked that I was neutral on this bill because, to be honest, we don't know exactly what it means, but we know the subject extremely well. In 2009, in the fall, we formed a fisheries committee to study this particular issue, wild trout, hatchery trout in the Mackenzie. The Mackenzie Club was formed in 1964. It also was the group that started the Federation of Fly Fishers in the country. We've got a lot of fishermen that know the Mackenzie, love it more than you can imagine, and so we're going to have a committee that we're going to resolve this issue that you're looking at now, or some facet of it. We had members that believe that hatchery fish should be removed from the Mackenzie. We had members that believe that no one should change what we've done for 75 years, and our goal was a consensus where no one would quit the club, no one would leave over this issue, but we would come up with a club position. And we met for 5 months every week. We sat on email, we talked. No one could even discuss anything but this when we met. And so we're real familiar with the subject matter. We tried to educate ourselves scientifically. We attended fishery conferences. We worked with ODFW. We worked in Salem. We worked with our local biologists. We came to a conclusion that didn't seem like much at the time, but apparently is pretty radical. We said that we felt that hatchery fish were harmful to native trout in the Mackenzie. That right there almost cost us a couple of members. But we put that position out. It's in our March 2010 newsletter. It's on the web. All of the information about the painful discussions and meetings is on there. The whole record is there for anyone that wants to see it. So we felt that the hatchery fish are harmful to wild fish, but we didn't believe that we should change the status quo without considering the local people that use the Mackenzie, the guides, the businesses that have depended on these fish for 75 years. So we are now working with the local ODFW doing a study of wild fish on the Mackenzie below Hendricks Bridge, counting, measuring, trying to see if an area that is no longer being planted is actually causing wild fish to thrive. We work closely with our local fish biologists. We try to cooperate with everybody on this issue. And we'd like to just stay informed, participate in the process if the state of Oregon is going to have a say in how this is resolved. So I'm neutral, but I'm advocating for my grandchildren in West Eugene and for wild and native fish and fishing experience on the Mackenzie. Thank you
for that perspective. I appreciate it.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Cannon, committee members. My name is Stan Steele. I live in Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Mackenzie River Guides Association. I actually grew up on the Mackenzie River at Leeburg Trout Hatchery. I'm a graduate of Mackenzie High, and after retirement from the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division, I actually went back to roots and went back to my guiding family roots and have spent the last 13 years working on the river. The Mackenzie has been described in historic magazines, in other words, 80 years ago, as Oregon's princess. The rogue was her queen, or correction, the rogue was the king, the Deschutes was the queen, and the Mackenzie was the princess. There's not even a question that it's one of Oregon's most well-used, heavily used, and well-loved rivers. But the thing that the task force concept gives us is the ability to have a citizen-led stakeholder group direct where it's going to go into the future. And that is something that we really feel strongly about as an association. When we look at a lot of the federal conservation plans that have been not thrust on us, because we've been members and have worked with agencies and stakeholders to develop those plans, but often the implementation project portion of that plan leaves out stakeholders. And as things progress, as things change, when those recovery plans are put into action and into motion, is what we want to make sure that a concept like the task force allows us to become involved, check, have measures, input, and the Mackenzie is a really important economic engine in the Upper Willamette Valley. Over 1,047,000 anglers freshwater fished in 2008 in the upper Willamette Basin. The majority of those, if they were river trout anglers, were in the Mackenzie. There's 44 miles left in Oregon of river trout fishing, drift boatable miles, 29 of those on the Mackenzie. I think that's out of 31,000 miles of trout-bearing stream. Approximately $1 billion a year comes into the state of Oregon from freshwater angling. Approximately 11,000 jobs are associated to freshwater angling in Oregon. So the issues on the Mackenzie are not unlike the issues on the Rogue or unlike the issues on the Deschutes or elsewhere. But I think the concept of having a task force, citizen stakeholder process is the way to resolve a lot of the issues. And so the Mackenzie Guides supports the concept and feels that working with folks who have different preferences, different opinions, is the way we will most profitably, conservation-wise, as well as economically and socially, come up with good governance. Thank you.
Thanks, Stan, and I'm glad you came back again. It's good to see you. If one of you will yield your chair, but stick around, we'll have questions of these four panelists in just a second. Joe, you're up. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I represent the Mackenzie River Guides Association. I have for several years here at the legislature. Like Stan, I grew up on the Mackenzie. I've also had the unenviable position of having been on one of the community teams for Marine Reserves. And when I started that process, I thought it was just horrible. I spent a whole year with 15 other people that I didn't particularly care for at the beginning. I didn't agree with at the beginning, but the trained facilitator helped us. So Stanley and I have been thinking about this concept. I've been talking to Representative Val Hoyle about it. And again, I have the Tom Wolf and I have committed to raise the money. We think it'll take about $12,000 to hire a trained professional mediator, have people who are appointed by the governor meet together and actually talk to one another. It's been my experience going to watershed council meetings and other things on this issue that the folks are very knowledgeable, they're very committed, but they talk past each other. So given that, thank you very much. I hope you will move this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Committee, we've got four testifiers, two up at the dais and two in the back. Do you have any questions for any of these gentlemen? Seeing none, we thank you all for your testimony. For the time being, and I'm sure, Mr. Chair, we're going to revisit this, I am going to close the first public hearing on House Bill 3451. And I would like to reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3535. It was a misprint. It was backwards in your agenda. It's actually 3535. The only individuals who are going to testify today on this are those that had signed up previously. If you have testimony and you're not part of that group, you are certainly welcome to submit it today or at another time to the committee. We'll look forward to that. By a show of hands, how many from that group that did not testify but who were signed up are in the hearing room right now? Hold them up. Great. On this side of the room, if you're one, please come forward and we'll resume 3535. Perfect. Including you, Sean. And Chair Cannon has reminded me that we are committed to 3 minutes each. So when you begin, the clock begins.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll be very brief. The League would like to voice its support for House Bill 3535 as amended. While we have several small issues with the bill, the League does support the adoption of a statewide energy performance score system. Oregon households currently spend over $4 billion on building-related energy expenses. Reducing this amount by just 5% through the use of an energy performance score system would free up over $200 million annually to spend for Oregonians to spend on other expenses and investments. As the bill is amended, energy performance reports for residences would be valid for 10 years. This follows a reasonable depreciation timeline that our cities often use for equipment. For the commercial sector, energy reports are generated using the Energy Star Portfolio Manager, a 100% free program. We believe that energy performance scores will provide potential owners and occupants with important information that will allow them to better assess the value of property and the costs associated with occupying that property. Unlike new appliances, the neighborhood of a surrounding a home, or the size of a structure, a building's energy performance is largely invisible to the untrained eye. Energy performance scores make visible what is otherwise not. Energy performance scores will reward the builders, property managers, and homeowners who are investing on improved energy efficiency, insulation, and new windows, and the like, and spur others to do likewise. This will provide transparency that is critical for a well-functioning market economy, and the League urges you to support 3535.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Chandler.
I'll defer to Mr. Gilliams for the opener, Mr. Chairman.
This is the first ever.
Wow.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Gilliams representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, unfortunately in opposition to House Bill 3535. Certainly, co-chairs and members, we support the concept of energy efficiency and improving the housing stock of Oregon. We just differ in our approach and how to get there. Should we focus on mandatory energy audits at the point of sale, or should we focus on voluntary incentives that actually encourage people to get the energy efficiency upgrades done? I think it's interesting when we talk about this 10-year window for the audit or the EPS score to be valid. Are we really focused on the score, or are we focused on people actually getting the improvements done? Because if they got the improvements done, that score is useless. You would want them to actually have the score done. I thought it was interesting, members, that we just heard a long conversation about creating a task force and members being appointed by the governor. And in fact, in 2009, you all elected to do that for this very subject matter. You passed Senate Bill 79, which created a governor's task force on whether or not energy performance scores were preferable for the state of Oregon. There were 13 members of that task force. They produced a 75-page document. That task force held 9 public hearings throughout the state over the course of 6 months. And I did forward a copy to committee staff of the report. I hope you all had an opportunity to see it. If not, I'll follow up with you. I'll give you the real quick highlight since I have 3 minutes, Mr. Chair. A majority of the task force did not feel that mandatory energy audits at the point of sale was the preferable way to go for the state of Oregon. In fact, out of the 13 members, only 2 supported that concept. Some of the reasons that they found that they didn't support that was the cost associated with it. I know you heard testimony earlier that the aspirational goal was $200 to $400 for an energy audit. When we met as a task force, the number was $500 to $700. This came out in September of 2010. $500 to $700 was the actual number that was calculated there. The Department of Energy went through and calculated how many new and existing home sales there are in a given year. At the peak, we were looking at 131,000 sales a year at a cost of $500. It was over $60 million a year cost to Oregonians. Even in our slow market, we're looking at over $30 million a year as a cost to Oregonians for these scores with no actual improvement in energy efficiency, because all that does is actually get you the score. It doesn't get the energy efficiency upgrades. Our recommendations that came out of the task force report, and I'm sure I'm running over 3 minutes, Mr. Chair, the recommendations were to strengthen a voluntary system. I'd urge you all to look at the recommendations the task force made for future legislation to strengthen the voluntary system. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll wrap up, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You are on time. We'll have questions in a moment. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to House Bill 3535. As the background noise for our opposition, though, I'd like to point out a few things to the committee that you might not be aware of. First is that Oregon buildings are built to the toughest energy code in the country, or one of the top 2 or 3, depending on how you measure such things. We've been doing that for quite a while. Mr. Gilliams mentioned Senate Bill 79. Senate Bill 79 imposed what's called a REACH code. We're trying to increase the energy efficiency of buildings, of new structures. We signed up for that. We have people serving on those committees. I was a member of the Earth Advantage Board when it first became a separate corporation from Portland General Electric. I was part of the group that hired Mr. Penrith, who testified to you last week. We have a green building position in our state association. We get a grant from the Energy Trust via PECI. His job is to work around the state with new construction on getting people to build more efficiently, both how the Oregon Code works and above code building. We support the energy performance score that you heard about last week. As a voluntary measure, we had a board resolution of endorsement of the energy performance score for new construction. We worked last session with Representative Bailey and others on the East bill. We believe very strongly in energy efficiency. We are doing energy efficiency. We think 3535 is a bad idea for the following reasons. Number one, it calls upon the Oregon Department of Energy to adopt a performance score for Oregon. The U.S. Department of Energy is already doing that. They're in the process of test marketing and pilot programming a variety of different scores, one of which is the EPS. Others are based on HERS and other sorts of methodologies. My assumption is that whatever the U.S. DOE picks will become VHS, and whatever else is left will be Betamax. We ought to wait and let U.S. DOE do its job. We're participating, Oregon is, in that process. We'll be at the table. Second reason is, since we're already doing, as a voluntary matter, new construction, we're working very hard, as hard as we can, to get what few new homes are built in an energy-efficient fashion. What this bill kind of does with regard to new construction is tell us to keep doing what we're already doing. Not sure we need the mandate. We agreed in good faith to take it on as a voluntary measure. We'd like to have at least a chance for, in a decent market, to make that happen. Third point, with regard to existing structures, both commercial and residential, it's very difficult to do. It's very expensive to do. As Mr. Gillian's pointed out, this bill, were it to pass, doesn't do a thing for energy efficiency. It gives people a piece of paper. The point of the exercise, I presume, is not to give people a piece of paper. It's to get them to do energy efficiency. The energy efficiency measures, whatever they might be, will still require money that chances are the folks who do them don't have, or they would have done them to begin with. And imposing a requirement at the point of sale simply means that house is either not sellable, because it has energy efficiency upgrades needed, or the seller has to somehow pay for those. I would submit that this is not the right time, A, to do that in a bad market. B, it's probably not the right way to do it, given that we're accomplishing a social goal by virtue of energy efficiency. In other words, Mr. Chairman, members, I don't believe this is a jobs bill at all, like you heard about last week, unless you count the energy auditors who have to be hired to do the testing. I think that this is a good idea. We would like to continue working on a voluntary measure to get more people in the field, get more people incentives to provide energy efficiency. I do find it more than a passing bit of irony that the day after this bill was being considered to require, implicitly at least require, energy efficiency upgrades, there is a discussion going on about limiting the residential energy tax credit, which would provide some of the incentive for folks to do so. I think as a legislative body, this is a very important issue, but ought to be approached in a comprehensive fashion. The last point I'll make, Mr. Chairman, echoes Mr. Gillian's with regard to the task force. You just set up or looking at setting up another task force on another issue. As I've been around this building quite a while, if you're going to set up a task force, respect the outcome of that task force, please. You're using people's time, volunteers, not lobbyists, but citizens who serve in good faith, take their time, spend their own money to participate in these things. It is annoying, at the very least, when a report is done and brings back and the legislature second guesses with a piece of legislation that basically ignores what the task force did. With that, Mr. Chairman, we continue to oppose this bill. We hope it does not come back. Sure, if you do so, we'd be glad to participate then. We'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for these three? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Kosher. Mr. Gillian, I'm curious if you could give the committee an update on the RMLS process and the decision to include energy efficiency information within that process.
Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Bailey. Unfortunately, I'm a little out of my area of expertise because we actually don't have anything to do with the multiple listing service at the state level. That's actually at the local level. However, I have had discussions with folks who are there about whether or not currently RMLS does have a field for green upgrades that are on a home, and I think that's a discussion that is ongoing. I'm not sure they came to a final conclusion on what else they would put, if they would put an energy performance score field in there or not, but we do already have a green energy efficiency field in the RMLS. Now, of course, that's a private entity that's not statewide. There are other multiple listing services in the state, but that's the largest one in the state.
It being Portland, the largest one.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, they serve the Portland area as well as Eugene area and some areas of the coast.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm just curious if you could walk us through the theory here. When an individual purchases a home, there are forms on lead paint disclosures. There are forms on all sorts of different information about property taxes and the anticipated cost to the potential buyer of taxes. Why is it important for a homeowner to know how much that home is going to cost them on their energy bill?
Co-chairs, Representative Bailey, first and foremost, I would say there is nothing in state statute that prevents them from asking that question. Absolutely nothing that prevents a buyer from saying, I'd like to see your utility bills, I'd like to know what the costs are. So there is no barrier there.
Please. I guess, and I appreciate that answer, I guess that what I was looking for was, given that we require, at least my understanding is a disclosure of, say, costs like taxes, why isn't this a similar part of the cost of owning a home that there's a public interest in disclosing to people ahead of time so they know what they're getting into?
Co-chairs, Representative Bailey, I think you'll find our objection is, one, the cost associated with this audit. It doesn't cost you anything to find out what your property taxes are. This particular bill would mandate a inspection that costs at the current market value about $500 to achieve. At current market situation that we're in, 39% of all properties are distressed. That means they're either a short sale, the person is selling for less than they owe, or they're a foreclosure. 39% of our market. And so when you add an additional $500 to that, that's a significant hit on those sellers. That also doesn't take into account sellers who are actually bringing money to the table and are not doing a short sale. They're underwater. I unfortunately saw a report that came out today that we've actually gone backwards from 2005 levels now in the home values, and the slide continues to go backwards. And so you're looking at more and more people underwater, Representative, and so it's a significant concern to mandate an additional $500 in order for them to sell their home.
Comment, Mr. Co-Chair?
Please.
For the record, speaking as somebody who in August sold a home that was underwater by many thousands of dollars and had to take in a very sizable check into the closing process, one that was difficult to stomach. I can fully sympathize with the challenges that are in the real estate market right now. However, I am also a fan of ensuring that we provide to Oregonians information they need to make wise decisions and to look at the person next to you. Mr. Chandler, I heard you make a comment that if they had the money, the upgrades would have been done already. Unfortunately, I believe that assumes perfect information within the marketplace. And while I think we may be having a dual conversation about the incentives and the programs that exist to get people to make the upgrades once they have the information, but it is also important to ensure that they have the information to do it, which is not always the case when one is in the process of buying and selling a home. But I am acutely aware of the challenges that people face selling homes that are underwater.
Are there other questions from Co-Chair?
Christopher, Chris, to your knowledge, are there jurisdictions in the state, cities in the state, that are interested in moving forward on local energy performance scores in the absence of a statewide requirement?
There most likely would be. Portland, of course, has a pilot project in the works that they're working on, yes, sir. That's the only one that I'm aware of. I know Eugene may also have an interest.
And follow up then, and what's your position, your respective organization's position on dealing with local energy performance scores city by city?
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, it would depend on what they do, frankly. The cities don't have ability to change the building code requirements absent a building code amendment with regard to new construction. If they imposed a score requirement that was simply testing the market, we'd probably argue with them locally as to what that effect that might have on their local real estate market, and we'd obviously participate at the local level when those decisions were made.
Co-Chair Cannon, our position has always been that the state statutory disclosure requirement, which is in ORS 105, should apply statewide, and so that all our members know and all consumers know exactly what's expected for disclosures. So we support a statewide system, and so I think, you know, you would see some concern about a mandated disclosure at the local level rather than the statewide one.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I mean, I think that is the way I see this heading. If we fail to act at the state level, I think there will be, at least in some jurisdictions, clearly not all, there will be an effort to apply these locally, and maybe they'll be successful in doing so, maybe not, but, and we don't know, of course, what form those would take, but I expect to see in my own city at least a very aggressive attempt to require energy performance scores locally. And I'm cognizant of the kinds of challenges that presents to the system when you have different standards in different places. It's a challenge for the auditors, it's a challenge for the sellers, it's a challenge for those who have to work within it. So I think there's some, whether or not this bill moves forward this session, I think we should consider the possibility of trying to get this done at a state level where we could standardize it rather than dealing with it locally.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I might follow up very quickly, I don't want to leave the committee with the impression that we don't support the idea of giving information out to consumers or support the idea of upgrading our housing stock. I guess the point I was trying to make was this bill is grabbing the wrong end of that discussion. With all respect to Representative Betty's point about perfect knowledge, it's also a perfect lack of financing. And in many cases, there are programs in existence that could be beefed up, certainly. Whether Portland or Eugene or Ashwood does a mandatory performance score begs the question of what you do with that information. Our point is, unless we're simply handing out pieces of paper for the sake of it, we want people to take steps to improve that property, either the seller before they sell it or the purchaser as part of the sales transaction. Otherwise, we have not increased energy efficiency at all. We've just given people information. It's that process of increasing energy efficiency that costs money. That's the problem we're worried about, is if you start impose things that cause houses to be sold less, then they can't be, or more difficulty, they can't be sold and bought new houses. That makes us nervous. People, the worst possible case scenario would be to impose a requirement that causes people not to be able to sell their homes because they are now at a disadvantage competitively, and they are sitting there then very angry with no net increase in energy efficiency. That strikes me as a bad outcome entirely. What I would like to suggest to you, please, is focus on how we help people make the improvements, give them the information, absolutely. That's why we supported the voluntary process in the first place, was to get that ball rolling, and I would point out to you, we did that right as the real estate market was sliding off the edge of the cliff, and as Mr. Julian's pointed out, we probably we're not done with the sliding yet. I would certainly argue with any local government that tried to do it, although I will point out, Representative Cannon, and most of my members don't build in the city of Portland, so bless their hearts. It would be nice to have more focus on how we get the work done, not simply memorializing it.
Thank you for your points of view and for your testimony, and committee, we're going to move on. Thanks all three of you for testifying. Now on this side of the room, if there are three that would come forward and identify yourself if you were on the list at the prior hearing, you are welcome to tell us in 3 minutes your point of view.
Chairs Cannon and Gilliam, my name for the record is Ivan Molesky. I'm the Conservation Director with the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. We have roughly 20,000 members across the state of Oregon. I'm here to speak to you in support of House Bill 3535 today, provided some testimony for the record. We see this as a key opportunity to spur continued growth in the energy efficiency job sector, providing consumers the tools that they need to make informed choices and create added value in the marketplace while reducing overall consumption of energy. This, by creating a system of measuring and standardizing energy performance scores, this bill essentially uses a market mechanism to add value and to encourage behavior. But essentially does not require that people ultimately engage in energy efficiency activities. We believe that this will, however, lead to increased demand in emerging energy job sector and home energy performance contracting and weatherization. And I did want to say I have provided you with an additional letter. It's not just us saying this. It's other folks from labor unions. You've heard testimony to this effect already. My colleagues at the Oregon and Southern Idaho District Council of Laborers have submitted a letter. I wanted to get that on your desk today as well. And they make a very good case on how this will benefit their members. It's often said that the most affordable energy is that which is not used. But not only are investments in energy efficiency the most cost-effective source of energy, there really are real jobs being created throughout Oregon in the growth of these programs that have had bipartisan support in this legislature. And so I'd like you to think of this bill in the context of augmenting and magnifying the impact of existing energy efficiency legislation that has passed this legislature in a bipartisan fashion in recent years. For example, in the recently completed 500-home weatherization project that emerged out of House Bill 2626 from 2009, the East Bill, 29 new jobs were created among a diverse array of weatherization contractors. Over 350 other jobs were sustained during 2010 amongst those firms. And most homes that completed the pilot experienced a 20% or greater reduction in energy consumption after their retrofits were completed. And while these programs are having a very real positive impact, they're simply not enough. And we need, and that's why we need a House Bill 3535 to magnify the impact of programs we've already put in place. What we've observed amongst our membership is tremendous demand to take advantage of these programs, the various incentives that the legislature has offered. And it's not just amongst our members, it's people of all political persuasion and all walks of life all across the state. I guess what I'd like to just leave you with is that Oregonians are very interested in realizing both the cost and energy savings benefits that energy efficiency can bring. And again, we urge this legislature to pass this bill and to think of it in the context of building upon your previous efforts and doing it in a bipartisan fashion. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Please identify yourself.
Co-Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. It's a special. My name is Peter Tofalvi. I am co-owner of Abacus Energy Solutions in Portland, and I am also a renter in Tigard. It is a special honor for me to testify today, since I've been only a citizen of this beautiful country since 2009. I grew up in communist Hungary, and I really hated that oppressive system. But the government there, in the middle of the 1960s, already built apartment buildings with double windows. In comparison, you can still find single-pane windows in apartment buildings in downtown Portland. I guess that the thinking of the owner is that it doesn't matter if it costs more to heat or cool the place in the summer, because the bill is paid by the renter. And that's the problem with the voluntary system. The person who pays the bill is not the same person who owns the place, in case of multi-family units and commercial buildings. Someone here even testified last week saying that it doesn't really matter because many renters leave their windows open all year around. Renters don't seem to care. I find that kind of reasoning cynical, and I hope you agree. My own apartment has insufficient insulation in the attic, and I offered the management to upgrade it free of charge. My company could do it easily. We do it every day. They declined. I guess because they think that if I do it, the neighbors will ask questions and they might want their own attic to be updated, you know, upgraded with more insulation as well. We can only inform the renters, we can only enable them to make educated decisions if we test and measure. If you don't measure, you can't improve. And somebody also brought up last week that a house in North Portland might have to withstand different weather than the house in Central Oregon. True, but let's develop standards, even if it is by city, but across the state, and then we can compare. And then the renters can vote with their feet. Now, if it becomes available, that sticker, like new cars have the miles per gallon sticker on them, if that information becomes available across the board, renters will start looking at that, and then basically the apartment buildings that had upgrades, weatherization upgrades, and are more efficient will be at more at demand. So the homeowners, or not homeowners, but the owners of these unit of these multifamily units that are progressive enough to invest will be able to recover their investment because they have higher occupancy rates, the tenants will stay longer, and they might be able to charge higher rents. So to spend $400 once will well worth it. Also, if you don't test, you don't know where the energy leaks are. It could be through the attic, it could be through the windows. Testing will tell the owner what are the most energy, the most cost-effective investments.
Thank you. Are you finished, Mr. Duvall?
Maybe just one more little thing. That
please wrap up. Be happy
yes,
to hear it.
Yes. And it is a job creation bill. My company is part of the High Road Community and Contractors Community Alliance. We pledge to pay prevailing wages to our employees, and when we also give full health insurance benefits that include the employees' children. When we hire, we also look for women. We prefer to hire women and disadvantaged minorities. So those people who are now, those young people who are now on unemployment benefits could be the weatherization workers of tomorrow if you just help this bill along and have it voted.
Thank you for your input and your perspective. Are there any questions for these two? Mr. Co-Chair.
I'd just like to thank you, sir, for your testimony. I really wish that you could respond to those who have written me saying that this bill represents a slide towards a socialist communist state. I think you're in a particularly good position to respond to that.
Yes, it has nothing, claim. Absolutely nothing to do with a communist state. It has to do with common sense. It saves the environment, it saves energy, and it saves money to many of your constituents.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions? If not, thank you both for testifying. Is there anyone else in the room? There is someone. Mr. Cross, you are saved for last.
Mr. Committee Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today representing Portland, BOMA Portland, and their Trade Association of Commercial Building Owners and Managers. And they have been very involved in energy efficiency and conservation efforts. They have partnered with NEAA, Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, and the City of Portland the last 4 years to do some funding for training on benchmarking, and have been working with the STAR Energy Performance Program, and have appreciated the gains in terms of energy savings that some of the buildings have been able to capture through that program. However, we are opposed to House Bill 3535, which would make for a mandatory energy scoring performance system. And I think you may have heard earlier, obviously, the task force that met during the interim through Senate Bill 79, and that group came out with the recommendation that the state use a voluntary program. And several of the reasons that they chose or that they identified for that decision was because of increased cost to property owners and governmental agencies, privacy issues with respect to disclosure, particularly when you're talking about commercial buildings, and the potential negative impacts on property values, there again for commercial buildings. And it's for those reasons that we oppose this bill. We would be happy to look at and have looked at a voluntary program, and we would like the state to identify a voluntary program because of our concern that, and I think Co-Chair Cannon asked the question earlier about, are there going to be jurisdictions, local government jurisdictions, that will want to adopt the programs? And we know the City of Portland is working on ordinance. We're concerned that they may embark on a program that might use one scoring system. City of Eugene might at some point look at a different scoring system. We are concerned that this legislation references a specific STAR program, STAR Energy Scoring Performance Program, and we're uncomfortable seeing something specific in statute naming a type of program because the technology is changing, and it may not be the best program to use 5 years from now, or 3 years from now. And particularly the program that's being touted, at least for commercial buildings, doesn't lend itself to good comparisons in terms of different types of buildings. And I've got in my testimony examples of why it's not a valid system in terms of comparing different scores with the average or with the standard that they'd like to see, a 75% score. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Cross? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for your perspective. And with that, committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3535. And we'll go here. And I'm going to open a work session. We're going to have two quick work sessions just for all those following along. The first work session I'm opening up is on House Bill 2191. And I would, in a moment, I don't think so. I will if you think you should.
Well, we had a dash to remember that we had a cab. Cannon's testified to it. What's that?
It's not managed, right?
No, you have in the paint, though, right?
Sorry.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I tell you what we're going to do first. If you would, Liz, just give us the summary, and then we'll ask folks to come forward and just tell us a little bit about the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2191 would provide that the Department of Environmental Quality may not disclose financial production or sales data of a producer obtained by the department as part of an approval for a plan for statewide architectural paint stewardship pilot program. There is a dash one amendment that has been submitted for the committee's consideration, and there are fiscal and revenue impact statements on that dash one.
Dash two.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Dash two. Amendments.
Palmer Mason, Scott Berry, we have been waiting for the two of you for some time. Please come forward.
You reemerge. Didn't we give you about a week to go off and work on this?
Has it been longer than that?
Yeah. Scott.
For the record, Scott Berry on behalf of the American Coatings Association Paint Care. And, yeah, it was a little longer than a week, members of the committee, but we are back with a rewrite which deletes the original bill and actually replaces it with similar language, frankly, that both DEQ and Paint Care support, and which does, of course, allow for that aggregate information from the program to be released to the public by DEQ, sort of under some parameters. With that, I'd be happy to kind of walk through what the bill does and Paint Care and all that stuff. We've been through that, but
I'm going to allow questions between each one. If you'll hold on, Palmer. Anything for Scott from that perspective? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious what the in aggregate form would reflect. What can someone that's looking at this actually learn? Because the in aggregate form, is that, maybe you need to describe that a little more clearly. What's being aggregated and what silos of information are there? What is it that people are actually going to see under this bill?
Co-chairs and Representative Bentz, our concerns, and then I'll get to the piece, was we wanted to make sure that information could be released to the public that allowed them to see that the money that was being added on to each can of paint before it was sold, that then goes to pay for this program, which is free once that's done in terms of the pickup, the delivery, and the reuse and recycling of paint, was clear without setting it up in a scenario that would allow for a reverse engineering of the information, where you could break down that information by contractor and sort of determine then what each individual bid inside of that program was. And in terms of the information that DEQ can release, I'll probably turn that over to Mr. Mason for his comments.
Any other questions for Scott at this point? If not, go right ahead, Palmer.
Okay. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Co-chairs Gilliam and Cannon, members of the committee, thanks for having me up here. Maybe I'll just start by trying to also add to Scott's comments for the questions raised by Representative Benz. I think the way that the department would answer that question, Representative, is there's a couple things here. One is that we have to determine that the information should be disclosed because there's a test here that we determine that that information, this financial information, is necessary for determining what the fee is, determining the expenditures as they relate to the program, particularly the expenditures as they relate to certain levels of service and associated cost. Once we've made that determination, then we go and look at the section of the amendment that is, section 1B, which describes some broad categories in which we can reveal this financial cost production information. And you see those categories there. They relate to collection, reuse, recycling, the waste reduction efforts, education and promotion, and the administrative cost associated with the program. Within those categories, we would release information in aggregate form that would relate to the level of service and associated cost for each of those categories. And I think, Representative, what that really means in saying we would release information in aggregate form is we're going to steer away from what Scott was just talking about, and that is not to disclose the specific price paid to a specific contractor or subcontractor to provide the services that are within those broad categories.
Please follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question really is this. It's not so much a competitor that might want to find this out as I would be interested in the DEQ explaining how it would come back to us and say that which is being charged to the consumer is the correct or too much or too little. How are you going to explain it to us in a way that that gets us to the true data, given this type of a restriction? Do we just have to take your word for it, or what are we going to see when you come in?
Co-chairs, Representative Bence, I don't think you'll simply have to take our word for it. I think what we'll be able to provide you is within these categories, which we believe represent where the expenditures are going to be made to manage the program, we would be able to provide you a comprehensive information and a level of detail, provided that the level of detail that we give doesn't involve an individual contractor and the price they were paid for the service that they provided paint care. But let's perhaps we could use an example. If the committee or a member of the public wanted to know how much paint care spent on recycling of the paint collected versus that which was disposed, we think we could provide in aggregate form all the costs of that information, and we could break it up by recycling versus the paint that was disposed. We could break it up by region if that was of interest to the committee or to a member of the public. We just couldn't, what I think we would do to try and interpret this language was avoid a situation where if, and I'm making these things up, paint care paid Acme processor X amount of dollars to recycle the paint, that specific contract and that specific price would be something we would not provide under this particular language. But I think that gives the public and hopefully the committee enough information to know generally where the money was spent and whether they got good performance and good service for that money.
Further question?
Follow up.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be sure that whatever we've created here still allows us to go to the public and say what you're paying is rational given the service you're receiving. And I want to be able to have the data available to back that up. So I need to ask, because I certainly haven't spent the time you guys have in trying to sort through this. Am I correct in hearing that you feel comfortable you'll be able to come forward and give us that summary and answer those two questions? Yes, folks are paying appropriate amount for the service they're receiving, and there isn't some huge profit being made or some other way we could be saving more money if we were able to share with competitors appropriate information.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Bence, I think that we can answer those two questions to say that the information we would be able to provide you or the public would be enough for the public to know that the money is being appropriately spent. As far as the anti-competitive aspect of it, certainly more information to entities that might either compete with paint care or compete with their vendors would tend in a market economy and in a competitive system to promote better bids and that sort of thing. So we are striking a balance here that does protect paint care's confidentiality and the type of bids that they have with specific contractors, and I want to be clear about that. That is different than, as Representative Bailey so perfectly pointed out earlier, that in a market economy we normally have perfect and available information. So I want to respect your question, Representative Benson, acknowledging that there will be limits to how much information is actually disclosed. But I think overall, in terms of the program and the expenditures and what the public is getting out of it, DEQ feels like we would be able to adequately represent that and allow for accountability, not just with PaintCare, but with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
The only thing I would add, again, Scott Berry on behalf of PaintCare, is that PaintCare is a nonprofit and that the money coming in to PaintCare is specifically for that use of recycling and reuse of the paint. And in fact, it's our hope that that because of the way this is set up, we'll receive bids that don't have previous information of costs of other contractors and will actually lead to a lowering of the cost per can. So that's, again, something we certainly hope for and we believe this helps us protect that.
And
please.
Co-chairs, if I may add, and Representative Benz, this is also, I just want to point this out. I think we talked about this at the last committee. DEQ will be bringing a report to the legislature in October of this year about the program, and we can certainly look at this issue and come back to you and to the committee to be sure in that period of time, have we written the language the right way? Is it accountable? Is it working? So I just want to suggest that that's an opportunity out there if that is something of importance to the committee.
Thank you for that. Thank you both for your work on this. We tease you about how long it took you, but I'm very appreciative of Representative Benz's questions. But I'm satisfied that the dash twos represent a carefully worded and worked out solution between the industry and the department that you've just sort of seen explained. And if there are no other questions or comments, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2191.
Co-Chair Cannon moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated March 4th, 2011 to House Bill 2191. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted, and I would entertain another motion, Mr. Chair.
I move House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Co-Chair Cannon has moved House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and to the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion on this portion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I would just echo your comments of congratulations and appreciate thanks to both of you for working through this. I think it's actually really important work that you did, in part because we may respond to industry efforts to try to deal with the end product in the way that the paint industry so responsibly has, and this may be a template for how we work through these kind of challenging confidentiality versus public disclosure issues. So I hope there's some precedent that you've helped set here. We'll check back in a couple of years and see how it's working.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. With no other discussion, I'm going to ask Ann if she'll call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gillian?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. Thank you both for your help. And do we have any carrier volunteers? Oh, that's so sad.
Mr. Chair, I will carry it.
Mr. Co-Chair, I appreciate that. Chair Cannon will carry the bill, and with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2191, and I am prepared almost to open a work session on House Bill 2827. If you would, Liz, just give us the quick update so everybody gets reset on what we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2827 would allow, between October 1st of any given year and February 28th of the following year, sale of biodiesel-containing additives to prevent congealing or gelling. There is a dash one amendment that is before the committee, and there are fiscal and revenue statements on both the bill as introduced and on the dash one amendments.
Thank you, Liz. Hold up just a second.
committee. I think, unless there's another comment on the bill itself, that I will, seeing none, I will entertain a motion on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Cannon moves House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I'll ask Ann to call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative
Benn?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Excuse, thank you.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye. And the motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. And I'm going to suggest Representative Wisnett be the carrier. And it's particularly easy to do since he's not in the room. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2827. And I'd like to open a first public hearing on House Bill 3538. Regarding 3538, I'd like our folks from the Climate Trust, are they in the room? Good. There you are. To come up and kick us off in this, if you would. Identify yourself for the record and please begin.
I'm Shauna Brownstein, the Manager of Policy and Government Affairs.
Co-Chair, members of the committee, this is Ben Vitale. I'm President of the Climate Trust. We have a very short presentation for you, and we really appreciate your time today.
Wonderful.
Shauna and I are here to testify in support of HB 3538 by emphasizing 4 points. First, this update allows the Oregon Standard to adopt widely accepted science and standards that recognize all 6 greenhouse gases. Number 2, there are no new costs to utilities or their customers for this change, and no cost to the state. The result will be a more cost-effective program, specifically due to the added flexibility. And fourthly, the flexibility will benefit new projects this year. So a little bit of history. The legislation passed in 1997 was the first in the country to limit carbon dioxide emissions. New facilities are required to achieve emission reduction 17% below the most efficient plant. The current statute restricts compliance paths using offsets only to carbon dioxide. There are 4 ways that utilities can can use to comply, namely implementing technology retrofits on site, managing their own project portfolio, providing a fee per ton to a qualified organization for the offset portfolio management, and fourthly, other means as determined by the Energy Facility Siting Council. To date, the 6 utilities have preferred to use a monetary path in the Climate Trust to meet their obligations under the standard. The offsets defined in 1997 statute clearly state an action that will be implemented by the applicant, a third party, or a qualified organization to avoid, sequester, or displace emissions of carbon dioxide. So this update simply allows a variety of offsets, including carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. The expected results of this update, if it is enacted, will provide immediate benefits to the program. First, the program will be more cost-efficient because utilities or the qualified organizations can pursue a greater variety of project types. Secondly, the Oregon Standard update will conform to widely accepted science and industry standards that have been established after 1997. Thirdly, in addition, HB 3538 aligns with the reporting requirements of Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and other state policies. And fourthly, and most importantly really, the update will promote new project types in rural communities. And Shauna will describe one such example and the characteristics of these high-quality projects.
So I just want to go through really quickly on how we choose these projects. We take a number of criteria into account. Quality, size and cost, location, and risk are four of the most important. Quality, we have really stringent quality criteria that we've developed and that the industry has actually adopted as best practice.
Excuse me just a minute.
Yeah.
Can you adjust that microphone toward you? I think there's some folks having trouble in the back.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Sure.
Great. So just to reiterate, quality, we have very stringent quality criteria that we've actually developed and were adopted by the industry as best practice. Size and cost, we work very hard to keep the price as low as possible. We want to spend Oregon ratepayer dollars wisely and get the biggest bang for our buck. Location. We give priority to Oregon projects, and this is actually included and is a requirement in our board-approved guidelines for acquisition. And finally, risk. We really want to look at the technology of a project. Is this technology tried and true? Is the partner a good partner? Are they going to be able to validate and monitor the project per statute requirements? And finally, does this project meet what we feel will be future regulatory requirements? Will our utility partners receive credit for these projects under future regulatory regimes? So what this all looks like on the ground, this is a project we've done through a project with Northwest Natural and Smart Energy. That's a voluntary program that they run. And it's a project developer called Farm Power. It's in Rexville, Washington. It provides renewable energy. It's a dairy digester, which takes lagooned animal waste, captures the methane, and generates renewable energy. The renewable energy that is generated with this project is enough to power 500 homes per year. The energy sale provides diversified revenue streams to dairy farms. In addition, the process results in a material that can be used as bedding for cows. This is a further revenue stream of $100,000 to $200,000 per year to these particular dairy farms. It reduces methane gas, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. In the last verification report that they submitted, they reduced 7,559 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. And additionally, this project follows industry standards and is very likely to qualify as early action. This is all relevant because this same project developer is looking to develop a project in Tillamook in Representative Boone's district. If this update passes, then we would be able to use funds from this project to fund the dairy digester in Tillamook. And with that, we are happy to answer any questions that you have.
And we're going to have some questions. I've got some. But we have neglected a colleague, and you can't imagine my embarrassment, but we are glad he's here. As soon as the lights come up so we can see his face.
You're able to see him.
I thought I could do that automatically because I was chair. Apparently not. My power's limited. I've seen him do it, but anyway. Representative Harker, will you address us even in the dark?
Gladly. Thank you, Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon. I'm Chris Harker, for the record, representative from House District 34, which is Beaverton and Cedar Mill. It's always nice to be part of a team where the whole project can go on without you. I try to do that in the business world, and obviously we've succeeded here. All I was going to do was make some introductory comments, and obviously things have proceeded very well without those comments. So thanks for turning up the light.
You're welcome. It's great to put a face with the voice. That's really all? That was great.
Everything I had was prefaced.
Okay, we'll keep moving.
And said what I had lead into it, and I don't imagine we need to go back to square one for that, unless
right.
You would really like me to.
No, I'm
happy to if you.
I appreciate you being here. If you can stick around, we're gonna ask some questions. Are there some questions of our friends here from the Climate Trust? I don't see any. Oh, Representative Boone.
He doesn't see me either. I'm invisible today. I just wanted to comment. Thank you for bringing that up. We do have a digester in Tillamook currently. and it's aptly called the Hooley Digester after our former Congresswoman Darlene Hooley, who helped us fund that and get that going. And it's very popular and successful. The cows eat the grass, do their thing, make power out of the thing, and then what's left becomes their bedding. And so then they, and then when that is, that's laid back out on the ground when it's moved. So it's recycled several times over. And remember that smell, the smell of money.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Derek Farmer told me that.
Do you, are there other questions? I was encouraged by your comment about Tillamook and now by Representative Boone's, because the only objection I had, of course, to that slide was that it was in the state of Washington. Unless anybody here has a Washington joke, this is a good time for it.
You'd know better than anybody.
Thank you very much. But my question, I guess, would start there. What are the percentage of the offset projects that are Oregon?
Yeah, so to date, 60% of the funds have gone into projects in Oregon.
And then I guess my next question, if there are none from the, maybe there are no. You played obviously a very big role. Is it your feeling that the Climate Trust is the only qualified entity to do this, or how do you feel about the expansion now we're 14 years in?
Sure. Good question. Thank you, Co-Chair, for the question. First, there's a long two-year process that included many members on a task force that created the NEED standard and the Oregon carbon dioxide standard. And it was a very thorough task force report was generated. And really, it's out of that process that the requirements in the bill, as well as the requirements for the qualified organization, made it into the current state that we have today. So I think that recognizing that detailed process is important. Number two, the current requirements on the qualified organization are important to ensure proper oversight and ongoing stakeholder engagement. We are specified under statute to have board members from utilities and FSEC, and that's an important process, not just at the beginning, but really ongoing, because the programs committee of the board approves, reviews, and approves every investment. And so to do that is a lot of time, a lot of effort by utilities, FSEC members, and others. And so we feel it's critically important for the integrity of that process to make sure that the governance structure and other requirements of the qualified organization are maintained.
Thank you for that answer. Let's go back to percentages. There's a lot of us, some rural, some urban representatives who are very interested in forestry and agriculture being included. What are percentages at the current rate that are under that category being
sure
offsets there, in that category?
Sure. There are three forestry projects in the portfolio today, and we've evaluated a number of other projects, other forestry projects, for the adding to the portfolio. One key thing is that the programs committee manages the risk in the portfolio and tries to make sure that the portfolio that we manage, portfolios actually, more than one, are balanced and across various sectors. And so we're very active also looking in the agriculture sector. Certainly you've heard one example here, but there are other examples that are emerging in standards in the industry around other kinds of emissions reductions on farms, nitrous oxide reductions or other reductions, carbon sequestration in soils. And those areas are emerging, so they will certainly hold promise in the future.
My last question is, please.
Hey, Chairman. Thanks. Am I right to assume that an expansion of the gases that could be recognized, that could be addressed in some of the offsets, if we were to go down this path, would actually make it easier to use to address issues on in agricultural realm than it is now?
Absolutely.
Yeah, certainly.
So that's part of the answer to why we want to expand. We want to include more. Your current protocols, do you think they limit or are they friendly to the expansion in the forestry area particularly?
Yeah, certainly. There are very well-known standards in the forestry sector. Since 1997, a lot has changed. Since 2005, a lot has changed. There are three recognized standards, one in California, and then the American Carbon Registry and the Voluntary Carbon Standard. Each of those has forestry protocols. So whereas the Climate Trust in the early days, because it was the first kind of compliance buyer in the U.S., actually had to develop those methodologies. But now we receive projects mostly that are following those standards, so we don't have to incur those costs, which it's quite costly to develop new methodologies.
I appreciate the answers. I appreciate the PowerPoint. That was helpful as well. Are there other questions for this panel before we move on? Representative Mintz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure if we're supposed to be looking at the dash ones, or are we supposed to be looking at the dash ones? Is that what we're looking at?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, the dash ones are basically a gut and stuff of what we had initially. The dash ones are the ones before the committee at this point. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And I would say, Representative Bentz, I hope to have some other amendments, and I'll share them with you as soon as they come out of LC.
Okay. I have a question about the dash ones.
Why don't you ask that right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 9, I'm just trying to understand the impact of the change suggested lines 8 through 12. Can someone explain that so I understand it?
Do you want to take it? It's a goal one.
Sure. Which line was that, sir?
It's the bold.
Page
the
9.
Bold. Okay. For purposes of determining the net carbon dioxide emissions, the Council shall by rule establish the global warming potential of each greenhouse gas based on generally accepted scientific method and convert any greenhouse gas emission to a carbon dioxide equivalent. Okay, so let me put this slide up that I prepared just for this question. Anyway,
there it is.
Essentially, there are universally accepted equivalents where carbon dioxide is the base. It's given a value of 1, and there are 5 other greenhouse gases: methane, nitrous oxide, hydrofluorocarbons, perfluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride. Each one is given a global warming potential over 100 years as it relates back to carbon dioxide. And in the language that you refer to, this would give FSEC the ability to determine the carbon dioxide equivalents of each of these gases as they change over time. We want to make sure that they have the ability to ramp them up or ramp them down as they are adjusted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a international body of Nobel laureate scientists that think about this stuff.
Follow up.
Please.
Sorry, just talking over here. Sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt your conversation.
That's okay. Happy to have it.
I'm going to pass on the Nobel laureate piece and just ask if this is going to require additional cost and additional testing, and I'm just, if so, how much? And I'm just wondering, when we adopt this, if we adopt this, what actually then happens on the ground? How many more Nobel laureates do we need out testing dairy farms? What's going to happen?
Nothing happens on the ground. There would be a rulemaking process. We anticipate that it would be very short, and it would be conducted by FSEC and Oregon Department of Energy. But these equivalent factors are very well established in the market, and there are many methodologies to follow that would allow us to very easily monitor and verify and quantify the amount of emission reductions. Nothing would change for us.
And basically, I would add, Representative, that basically FSEC would note which quantification they're going to follow. So it's really looking at it, are they going to follow the US EPA, which relies on the IPCC guidance, which is what Shauna presented. So it's really identifying the reference under the rule.
Chairman, please.
What I'm trying to get at is this. It astounds me how many lawyers and Nobel laureates and engineers and testers that these devices require. And every one of them has a cost. And what I'm trying to get at is whether what we're doing here expands the need for more measurers and testers and lawyers, because I see this as a, well, as we work our way through these, that group grows larger and larger. It's a full employment act for folks that are in the measuring business. And so I'm just wondering, does this language add to that already lengthy line of folks necessary to see if we're in compliance with these standards we're creating?
No, sir, it doesn't. We are already required to monitor and verify our projects, and this does not add any additional cost. We are still going to have to monitor and verify everything.
Follow up, please. Then if it's not a measurement issue, what is the benefit from doing this? If we already know it, tell me why we need to know this. What is it that is so great about what we're doing? How do we move our whole ship of state forward as a result of knowing this?
Yeah, basically, the what that three-line or single sentence does in the statute is specify the reference that's being used for, let's say, methane. So you just need a reference, because only line one, the carbon dioxide, is allowed today. If we allowed carbon dioxide and methane, for example, then you have to just have the reference to what calculation are you using for the global warming potential of the methane. And so it's well established. There's some small, slight differences, but it's really basically a do once by FSEC rule setting to name what the reference is for the quantification.
Good.
And they exist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oddly enough, I do follow that, and it also helps to have Nobel laureate Bailey sitting next to me and helping fix kind of
screwing out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I chime in?
Please.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam, Representative Bence. Some of the introductory comments, I think we're going to go to this issue. This is not a question of regulating more gases. This is a question of expanding the gases which can be addressed in the offset projects.
Right. Thank you.
Are there other questions for this first panel? If not, thank you all for the presentation.
Thank you.
And I'd like to move on and ask Matt Delaney and Duncan Berry if they'd come up.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Delaney. The reason I'm here today is to support the passage of HB 3538 with amendments. I would like to thank Co-Chair Gilliam for working with us on some amendments under the committee's consideration. I'm a forester. I specialize in carbon offset projects. I reside in Sotaville, Oregon, about 25 miles east of Corvallis. I've got 15 years of experience in forest carbon offset project development and implementation. I've worked in most U.S. states on forest carbon offset projects in 12 countries internationally on projects totaling about 2 million acres and more than $20 million worth of project investment. I am the Vice President of Project Development for LNC Carbon, which is a new forest carbon offset project company based here in Salem, and it's a subsidiary of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And our focus is on developing forest carbon offset projects in Oregon and across the Pacific Northwest. Since this law was passed 14 years ago, it seems that a significant change is now being considered to expand the types of offsets allowable. And we would urge a much more comprehensive update of the bill to ensure that it works best for Oregon. The three key points that we think are important for the committee to consider are ensuring that at least 50% of the qualified offsets are carbon dioxide offsets as opposed to other greenhouse gas offsets. Ensure that Oregon offset projects have priority over state or country-based projects. And thirdly, expand the opportunity for other groups to participate as qualified organizations under the statute. And real quickly, Oregon has some of the greatest sequestration assets in the world. We have highly productive forests and agricultural lands, and I think there are great opportunities to develop carbon dioxide projects, offset projects here in Oregon, while enhancing forests and agricultural lands. By expanding the qualified offset definition beyond CO2, that is a possibility that more resources could be spent on non-forestry and non-agriculturally based offset projects under HB 3538 as it's written. And we encourage the committee to consider an amendment to change that. There's no limitation on geographic location of offset projects to achieve the Oregon carbon dioxide standard. Since all the emissions are generated here in Oregon, we are of the opinion that the offsets of these emissions should be generated in Oregon as well. Creating offset projects in our state will support and reward Oregon landowners for sustainable management and create jobs relating to developing these projects. As the bill is now written, it creates the possibilities that it could be expanded to other places globally, especially the ones that involve HFC and sulfur hexafluorides, which are often projects that are based in Southeast Asia, for example. When this bill was passed 14 years ago, there was only one organization designated as qualified organization, and I think while that was prudent when the carbon offset market was in its infancy in 1997, it's not the case today. There are many other companies that are qualified to provide development and implementation services for carbon offset projects, and we feel other organizations should have an opportunity to qualify under HB 3538 to create competition under this program and ensure that Oregon stakeholders are getting the best value for their project investments. In conclusion, we want to thank the committee for the consideration of these issues, and LNC Carbon supports the expanded definition of greenhouse gases, but we strongly believe that it should be designed to give priority to Oregon-based forestry and agriculture offset projects, in addition to providing an opportunity to meet the definition of qualified organization to ensure competition and efficiencies. Thank you.
Thank you for your perspective. Please.
Yes. So co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam and members of the committee, my name is Duncan Berry, and for the record, I am from the Salmon River watershed in Otis, Oregon. I'm here both as an individual, a utility ratepayer, as well as the president of a company called Ecosystem Services, LLC. We specialize in bringing to market those products and services that nature provides to rural communities and the natural systems in which they are located to drive a healthy balance. And carbon is one of those services that nature provides us. We are here in support of House Bill 3538, also with some proposed amendments. I will echo much of what Mr. Delaney just said about the fact that the world has changed since 1997 and the inception of the Oregon carbon dioxide standard. And I think 14 years later, we have relinquished the leadership that was referred to earlier to the states to the south and east of us in the carbon field. So the question really it begs is, how did we lose that leadership? And I think if you look at the model of other states, it was largely due, I believe, and many others agree, that it was the making of a single nonprofit entity the sole steward to manage the industry, energy industry's investment in offsetting their emissions, and that has proven in many ways to be a costly mistake. There are three facts which really support that, and they echo some of what Mr. Delaney said as well. One is that there's been a marked lack of success in financing Oregon-based projects. Much of the 60% of those projects was focused in urban environments. Again, despite the fact that Oregon has been identified as one of the greatest carbon sequestration sink assets in the world, this is focused mostly on their forests. Along our coastline, Representative Boone. Because of this lack of local focus, millions of dollars have left this state for to fund projects elsewhere. And lastly, as far as we know, not one of these projects has met the approved per ton price as set by EFSEC, in many cases exceeding it, or in one case at least that we know of, exceeding it by as much as 1,000%. This means that the worthy idea of having Oregon's energy facilities be carbon neutral is not being met. We have an opportunity, though, in House Bill 3538 to correct our course. The proposed amendments would ensure that a new and competitive process would be created by which, which carbon offset projects would be identified and brought to market, and unlike 1997, there are currently many qualified entities in Oregon to perform this function. Secondly, a clear preference would be given to keeping the dollars here in this state, while nurturing the capacity of this state to be a major player in the billion-dollar voluntary carbon market, regaining some of that lead that we've lost. And then finally, that a specific amount of these projects would be required to focus on the sequestration of carbon dioxide because, after all, these energy facilities, that is it is the major gas they are emitting. And they also, that supports a bio-based carbon projects in the key Oregon sectors of forestry and agriculture, obviously near and dear to us. Lastly, as a note, we have shared these same suggestions with Governor Kitzhaber during a briefing on five critical steps to create explosive growth in the carbon economy, in which we must play a role. They are also supported by other members of the legislature. I would urge this committee to establish a working group to review House Bill 3538 and incorporate those amendments they feel will strengthen the bill and make this carbon offset process a more cost-effective and more inclusive process. And I think when you review the amendments, they make common sense, and Oregon and Oregonians will be better for it. I'd also be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your input.
So just a quick comment that some of these, I appreciate the testimony and the suggestion, some of these goals may be in tension with each other. For example, cost effectiveness may be at times in tension with doing projects in Oregon. Those may sort of push against each other. Or cost effectiveness may be in tension with restricting it to carbon-based offsets. There may be more affordable opportunities by expanding the greenhouse gas list. So I appreciate the suggestions. I think that there's a lot that would need to be talked through to move to achieve multiple goals simultaneously, which I think is what you're suggesting.
You're absolutely right.
Thank you for that comment. I'd say this. I've got some questions, and obviously I want to have the opportunity to talk some more about the amendments that we've discussed, and I'll make sure those are distributed. In the interest of time, however, unless there are some other questions or comments for this panel, and with the permission in the future, I have to discuss it with my co-chair as we move forward with either a work group, which is one suggestion on the table, or an additional hearing. I'm hoping you'll come back and be part of that. But I think for now, if it's okay with the committee, I'm going to close temporarily this public hearing. If you are in the room still to testify, hang with me. I want to pick up one other testimony that was on the docket today. So I, for the moment, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill, what are we on? 3538. And I would like to first verify that Jerry Bryan is in the room. Good. Jerry, come on up as I open the first public hearing on House Bill 3571. I know you've come a long way, and I want to make sure you have the opportunity to do this. It's a little jumbled, but we're going to take testimony from you and Representative Clem, and then we'll go back. Representative Shiprack, former Representative Shiprack, is probably thinking this is one heck of a way to run a committee, but hang in there with me, Bob. So please. Representative Clem, maybe you'll kick us off.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a fantastic moment to get to see you attempt to run a committee. I also noticed Mr. Chair, did not put your committee administrator between you two, and they let you actually talk to each other. They will not allow Co-Chair Jensen and I to do that for some unknown reason.
Well, we know why.
For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from House District 21 and Co-Chair of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Are you two talking about me? I'm sitting right here, you know. Sorry.
We're trying to solve your problem.
Anyway, I have provided for you a letter that I think summarizes the issue involved in House Bill 3571 quite well. It's from the, it says Rep. Clem on it, signed John Savage. He's a PUC commissioner. And the issue is essentially for, and others will talk to it, the issue involved, and I got involved because it's primarily farmers who are the ones that own these little power generators, though there are some biomass facilities and a few others. At the time contracts were being negotiated long ago for long-term 20, 30-year contracts, nobody knew that environmental upgrades would actually have any value as an asset that could be owned or sold or gleaned from. It's more if you did the right thing, you know, you're just doing the right thing. And at some point, and Farmers Irrigation District here will tell you about that, they figured out that doing right by nature and fish also could mean serious dollars for your bottom line and help growers have lower irrigation costs, help upgrade sprinkler heads for free for growers so they could have lower water bills, all those kinds of things. The question is, now that we know that these environmental assets actually have value, who owns them? The person who created them or the utility that buys the power? Well, starting in 2005 going forward, any contracts that are now being made, it's clear that it resides with the generator and that the utility would, you know, pay for those assets if they want them by buying them, and or the generator could go sell them somewhere else if they get a better deal. What this bill does, or intends to do, is defines that on the remaining contracts that are still out there, that still exist, that will expire in the near future in some cases, in very near future in some cases, that those environmental attributes also reside with the generator, unless as part of some contractual relationship, some contract, they had been acquired by the utility. And the public policy question here is, why would some small farming irrigation district made up of a bunch of farmers or a biomass facility, why would they invest in environmental upgrades if they don't get the asset that comes with investing in environmental upgrades for to then sell? Otherwise, why do it? There's no point in doing that except for the goodness of their own hearts, which, you know, a lot of farmers do that. But anyway, that's the basic issue involved here. There are a couple sets of amendments, dash ones and dash twos. I think there probably needs to be some additional discussion because until late today, the one of the utilities I was talking to actually didn't understand this was really about retroactivity, and so now they do, and I think you'll hear some of their concerns that I didn't know about until a few hours ago. I just had heard that everybody was fine with the bill. So we will discuss that and see if there's any, you know, thing that can be done. But I also want to just flag for you this little email here summarizes not only the issue, but also why we're having to deal with this instead of the PUC, and that's because although they say they support this bill and support this concept and do believe that the RECs should reside with the generator, they would have to go through every single one case by case by case by case, would take literally, it says years, to work through all these contracts. The other option is let the courts litigate this and make all these little farming irrigation districts and biomass get lawyers, and they and the utilities would duke it out in court, or the legislature can just define it for us, for the irrigators and generators of these power, and have it resolved here instead of having to go to court over it, which is my goal, is to try and help. You know, obviously I'm the chair of the Ag Committee, so my goal is to help the farmer in this particular situation, but I'm not interested in ripping off the big utilities. I just want to make sure that if they have paid for something, they get it. If they haven't, they still have to buy it at a fair price, not get it as a matter of gray area in the law, which is what we're a little bit nervous about.
Well, thank you for that lengthy but substantive introduction. Well, and if it's okay with you, Representative, we're going to toss it to Jerry, and we invite your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. I'm Jerry Bryan from Farmers Irrigation District. The written testimony you have before you is from Mike Kleinsmith, the manager of the district. He is sicker than anything that's even remotely compatible with public presence. So he asked me if I would come down and add in a little bit with regard to renewable energy certificates and what it means to irrigation districts and why this whole business of ownership, who owns the REC, is particularly important. In the case of Farmers Irrigation District, just by way of full disclosure, Farmers Irrigation District just recently renegotiated a power sales contract. So the environmental attributes for Farmers Irrigation District are clearly called out as belonging to the Farmers Irrigation District. So why is Farmers here? Because as an irrigation district in partnership with all of the other irrigation districts in the state, one of the things that we've found over the years, as Representative Clem mentioned, is that if we have sources of revenue, such as, for instance, this new opportunity via renewable energy certificates, but over the years via the revenue from small-scale hydroelectricity, we are able to very aggressively pursue water conservation and management projects. We're able to replace open canal with pipe. We have even committed in a number of districts to stream restoration projects. The other thing that revenue from hydroelectricity, whether directly or via renewable energy certificates, the other thing that it does is allows us then to enhance the production of additional renewable energy into the grid, and it allows us to remove individual pump systems, which decreases energy consumption. So there's a positive synergy associated with revenue coming to irrigation districts and these small-scale energy projects, and to the extent that all of us in the state as irrigation districts are able to make deep and real contributions to ecology, that's why we are speaking today in favor of the proposed legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming. I'm glad we also have Mr. Kleinsmith's written testimony, but we appreciate your perspective. If there aren't any quick questions for these two, seeing none, I want to thank you both for your testimony. It's certainly a joy to see you again, Representative Clem. And
it's been really lovely.
Committee, we're going to have some other folks testify on this when we carry this over. But I wanted to make sure we got started today. And Mr. Steve Johnson, if you're listening out there on the internet, we'll invite you and inform you of when that is as well. So for now, I'm going to close and hold over this public hearing. Is that correctly said? For House Bill 3571, and I would like to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3538 and ask if Bob Shiprack, Todd Wynn, and Chuck Wise would come up. Is that right? Would come up right away. Weiss, I'm sorry if I screwed that up. Mr. Chair, I'm talking to you.
Been a while.
We're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, and I'm here today representing the State Energy Facility Siting Council. I've spent almost 8 years on that council. I'll be term limited here in a couple months. I just wanted to pass along to you the long interest the Siting Council has in this issue. Your statutes have the Climate Trust reporting to the Facility Siting Council, who, of course, is a part of the Department of Energy. Annually, we get reports from the Climate Trust on how this money's been spent and what the projects are, that type of information. We became aware that for some reason, and we can't find out through the archives or whatever, that in apparently 1997, the legislature, when this trust was created, limited to just one greenhouse gas, CO2, which is, as you saw from the demonstration that Shauna put on the screen, is the mildest greenhouse gas there is. The Siting Council, I should tell you, I'm the only one from the Valley of Western Oregon on there. This is a pretty conservative group of rural people that represent the state of Oregon. There were two things that we wanted changed through this legislation. One, we wanted more Oregon jobs. It was clearly that was one criteria, and I'll talk about that in just a second. Secondly, as it was demonstrated by Ben and Shauna's testimony, modernize this statute to start recognizing other greenhouse gases. That's what this money's for, and you've got much more dangerous gases out there that we can't spend money on. Let me just, in closing, I just want, and what kind of got me interested in this is one of my younger brothers is an electrician, and last year he was dispatched to Goldendale, Washington, to a landfill where a local contractor, a large regional contractor, installed 30 megawatts of steam turbine generating equipment on the Goldendale landfill. This is electricity. Now, 30 megawatts, that's a healthy amount of power. 24/7 electricity. We're talking base load electricity. A 50-year supply of fuel under the ground. It created, just from the estimates I heard from the contractor and himself, probably about 50 construction jobs at the time. But it was a real good use, I think, of money. Under Oregon's current law, we could have invested in that project, but we couldn't invest in the same project in the state of Oregon because it's illegal. Because methane is not recognized as a greenhouse gas. So that's what the intent of this is. And it goes in the other thing I want to say, when we talk about agriculture, and the other members of the council are mainly from ag areas, just remind you that methane and nitrous oxide are key agricultural gases that we want to see regulated. So it's really important that we expand it and get away from just the CO2. It's a good government bill. It gets overused. I think it's a jobs bill. And I just wanted to let you know the council gives its strong endorsement to this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your perspective and for the council. Todd.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am Vice President and Energy Policy Analyst with Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research organization based in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to testify today against House Bill 3538, and I've provided my written testimony, so I'll just summarize kind of the key points because I know it's getting late in the day. This bill would, in effect, change the original intent and purpose of House Bill 3283, which was passed in 1997. That purpose is to regulate and reduce carbon dioxide emissions from regulated facilities by implementing carbon offset projects. As we know, the Climate Trust is the only qualified organization currently in the state. Now, my major three points is the first one is Climate Trust is not transparent in its operations. Many documents, such as funding and dollar amounts spent on certain projects, are unable to be retrieved or accessed. And the Climate Trust annual reports have not been accurate updates. They've been overly positive reports addressing self-proclaimed success and not mentioning failures or specifics of projects. Because the Climate Trust's existence is a function of state law regulating facilities, they should be subject to the same standards as public agencies for the release of public records. Allowing the Climate Trust to offset emissions and expanding this program to offset other emission types without the public provisions, proper provisions for public oversight is a mistake, in my opinion. The next point is the Climate Trust has failed to reduce carbon dioxide according to the original law. So there's no justification for expanding this program. I'm not sure that failure is a justification for expanding operations. Cascade Policy Institute finished an audit on the Climate Trust offset projects in 2009 and found that the Climate Trust overpaid for offsets above and beyond the monetary offset rate. That led to an offset shortfall of about 650,000 metric tons and a waste of about a little over $1 million in ratepayer funds. The audit showed there were numerous problems that undermine the quality and effectiveness of Climate Trust projects, lack of additionality, accountability of funds, inaccurate assumptions, difficult in verifying and monitoring results, lack of permits and leakage issues are just some of the problems affecting their projects. Knowing the already documented failure of the Climate Trust, assuming the Climate Trust will be more successful with more options to meet the standard is simply bad public policy. Now, I know this doesn't count for much, but I know a couple of you have laptops open. If you Google Climate Trust scam shows up on the very first page. Allowing the Climate Trust to have more options in offsetting emissions opens up the opportunity for more waste and fraud. The majority of fraudulent carbon offset or offset projects in general have stemmed from greenhouse gases other than carbon dioxide. Massive fraud on the international scale has been attributed to the destruction of HFC-23, a refrigerant gas, where the carbon offset credits sold to reduce this gas actually are twice as valuable as the refrigerant itself. An estimated 40% of clean development mechanism offset projects have represented unlikely or at least questionable emission cuts, according to numerous studies. Even the federal government has indicated that offsets and the offset mechanism is ripe for the possibility of fraud and abuse. We should not allow the Climate Trust to have more options in pursuing even more fraudulent and questionable offsets. The Climate Trust has proven itself to be wasteful, non-transparent in its operations, and there's no indication or results that have proven the Climate Trust should enjoy the additional ability to reduce other greenhouse gases according to the law. Allowing the Climate Trust to offset more than carbon dioxide violates the original intent of HB 3283 and opens the door for more fraudulent, non-additional offsets at the Oregon ratepayer expense. I urge the members of this committee to vote no on House Bill 3538.
Thank you for your testimony. Please, Mr. Glass.
Yes, Ms. Representative Cannon, or Co-Chair Cannon and Gilliam and the rest of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I came down here in support of what Todd Wynn just said, but what really made me and triggered me to come down today was I had just read the Global Warming, Oregon Global Warming Commission's report that
just pull that microphone back away just a little.
Okay.
There
all right. I read the Global Warming Commission's report to the legislature and to the governor's office just a couple of days ago, and conspicuously missing in that report, which is very important for them to submit to this legislature and to the governor, is all relevant climate data up to date that shows what's actually been happening to the climate with respect to all the claims that were made by climate modeling that the climate is warming from carbon emissions. It's not there, so I submitted that in this testimony that I'm giving you today. And I'd like to point out to you that the Earth is not warming. It stopped warming over 10 years ago, and that's reflected in the global satellite temperature record, which is well kept by Dr. Roy Spencer at the University of Alabama at Huntsville. Not only is the temperature not warming in the satellite record, which includes the oceans, if you look at the National Climatic Data Center's records for the last 10 years over the 48 lower contiguous United States, the climate is actually cooling, and it's dropped by 0.97 degrees Fahrenheit in the last decade. Both of these temperature trends are completely at odds with the climate models, which are the very things that are being used for the very premise that's made that we need to control carbon emissions. The second thing that's very disturbing to me that I read in this report that you should all think about very carefully is that according to these people that did the carbon emission calculations for Oregon, they say that Oregon's annual contribution to carbon emissions in the atmosphere is 68 million metric tons per year. That's right out of their report. The global concentration measured in parts per million by volume is 391.76, and just for the record, which I also included, that's been going up right along with the declining temperatures, exactly at odds with what all these models had said. Now, if you convert 391 parts per million to a mass equivalent, it's about a little over 3 trillion metric tons of carbon dioxide. In other words, 3.158 is what I came up with. And the significance of that is, if you compare it to what they claim Oregon emits, it's only 1/1000th of 2.153%. So if you took all the carbon reduction strategies that are recommended by the Oregon Global Warming Commission, you could implement any percentage of those reductions that you wanted. And you could say, even if you believe there was a climate emergency and we had to reduce 100% of emissions, in other words, the whole 68 million metric tons, if you did that, you would only reduce the free air concentration by 0.1% of one part per million by volume. That is so small you cannot measure it. And the significance of that is, it is the global free air concentration in parts per million that's plugged into the climate models, which give these frivolous predictions that the Earth is warming from CO2 emissions. So if we can't reduce our carbon emissions even enough to make a dent in the free air parts per million by volume,
value, what are we doing even entertaining carbon reduction emissions? I also calculated a number that's not in this report, but I just did it to see what it would come out to be for the entire United States based upon the EPA's calculations of what the entire carbon emission spectrum is for the whole 48 lower states. If you ran it for those numbers, you could only reduce the parts per million by volume by 72 hundredths of one part per million by volume. That's if you shut down all carbon emissions everywhere in the United States. If you run the numbers, this is an exercise in frivolity. It makes absolutely no sense, and I encourage this commission to double-check my numbers because I know I did them correctly. There's no point in even entertaining this if we're going to base everything we do on the assumption that the climate modeling is what gave us our idea we should reduce emissions, and yet everything in our reduction strategies doesn't even allow us to move that number by one peg off the meter. I would also disagree with the earlier comments made about the IPCC. It is not a scientific body, it's a political body. It has scientists that contribute to what it issues to the public, but it is a thoroughly discredited agency, and the scientists within it are very much at odds with what they believe or don't believe about what the global warming is with respect to these greenhouse gases. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and colleagues that are still here, thank you for staying. We have one more person, if you'll just hang with me. If you have any quick questions for this panel, I'd be happy to entertain those. If not, thank you all for your testimony. I appreciate your perspective very much. And it's Brendan, isn't it? Brendan. Come on up.
You know, members of the committee, you know what they say. You keep the utility guy for last. I mean, they say about, you know, utility people, we boldly go where someone else has gone before.
Here you go.
Anyway, I'll keep it brief. Brendan McCarthy, representing Portland General Electric. Portland General Electric is an investor-owned utility serving 822,000 customers in the Northern Willamette Valley, six counties, 52 cities. We pay on the monetary path to the Climate Trust. When we sited Fort Westward, our last natural gas-fired facility, we paid about $5.7 million for offsets. We are in the process of going to RFP for two other gas-fired facilities, so we'll be paying in the next near future something in the category of about $10 million. So we have a very vested interest in ensuring that our valuable partner in the Climate Trust can do their task efficiently and effectively. I just want to clarify a couple of things. Number one, that hasn't been mentioned yet. When the Climate Trust went to FSEC last summer with their concerns about their investments, the Energy Facility Siting Council appointed a CO2e equivalency or asked the Department of Energy to appoint a CO2e group. That group met in September and October and agreed, it was a group of stakeholders, and they agreed that expansion of the gases was warranted. Number two, it also hasn't been really talked about in too much detail, is that, you know, the way the statutes are framed, it's just not quite possible to invest in other gases the way it is, so I think the expansion really is absolutely necessary. And finally, clarify one item. This is not a standard that makes projects carbon neutral. That was a comment earlier. This is new power plants have to reduce their emissions by 17% from the cleanest power plant in the United States. If they can't do that either by making a more efficient power plant or doing their own offset projects, they can take the monetary path. So Port Westward still emits carbon. The offsets don't make Port Westward carbon neutral. They reduce it from the previous bogey, which was less efficient than Port Westward. And Port Westward actually is so efficient that it is the new bogey for the standard. So with that, I'll leave the rest of the comments because I think other people have already made my other points. And in consequence of your time, quarter after five, I'll let you go.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your patience in staying with us. Any questions at all for Brendan? Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3538. Am I carrying it over?
Is there anyone else left to testify?
No.
Then I close that public hearing, and I adjourn the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water, and thank everyone.